From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we explore Camp Reunite. It's a program that gives kids with incarcerated mothers an opportunity for family bonding.
A lot of the women got up and went outside and were waiting in a row watching their kids get off the bus and watching their kids go through security. And it was just very tangible excitement and anticipation. You could tell it meant so much to everyone who got to participate in that day.
We'll chat with best-selling author Chuck Klosterman ahead of his appearance in Milwaukee later this week. And it wasn't so long ago that many Americans were a meal or two away from starvation, which partly explains our embrace of processed and shelf-stable foods.
That ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials, when it first started, that really served a great purpose and helped people.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. In the United States, more than 5 million children have had a parent in prison. And while the parent may be the one incarcerated, their family also pays a price. A program called Camp Reunite at Techeeta Correctional Institute is providing these families an opportunity to bond and heal alongside their incarcerated loved ones. Allison Dukanovich is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She's been reporting on this story, and she joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers and starts by describing what the program offers.
It's a summer camp where kids go away to camp for a whole week, and then there's 2 full-day visits where they get to go and visit their moms at Techeeta and spend 2 full days with them in a really family-friendly environment.
So for people who may not know much about Techeeta, what is that prison like?
Yeah, so Techeeta is up. It's up in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, so it's a few hours from Milwaukee. It's in a pretty rural area. It's a large campus. And usually there are really strict security measures and protocols for when people get to visit, even when kids get to go and visit their parents there. It's all women at Techeeta. It's a women's correctional institution. So when kids go visit, usually they have to go through all these security measures. But for Camp Reunite, they kind of amended a lot of those rules on purpose. They wanted it to feel really natural and organic and for it to feel more just like a mother and a child interacting if they were at home. And so the moms got really excited. They had been preparing for over a month for their kids to come, and they set up a whole carnival. So they kind of turned the whole outdoor visiting area into a carnival setting. And in the visiting room, they had decorations and posters and signs and arts and crafts stations set up. So it really felt like a child-friendly environment. It didn't feel as sterile as the prison usually would.
You know, as you mentioned, it was this kind of carnival setting. It was much more relaxed than your standard prison visit. And, you know, the way that mothers were able to interact with their kids is very different than they normally are able to do.
Yeah, it was some of those kind of little moments between moms and their kids that normally would be against the rules, even just like doing each other's hair. I talked to one mom who got to braid her daughter's hair, which she said she used to do every morning, but wouldn't normally be able to do in prison. And one mother and her son were playing football together and running around and throwing a football, which normally wouldn't be able to do. So just all these different kinds of interactions, even just being able to hug your mom for an extended period of time is usually against the rules. And this is what the prison warden, Sarah Cooper, had to say about why they chose to do that.
We've designed this camp to be set up like a family atmosphere, not so much like a prison visiting room. So the moms and the kids, they can walk around hand in hand, they can have their arms around each other for the whole time if they want. We really try to replicate an environment where if the kids and the moms were at home together, what kind of fun things would they be doing together?
So much of this is about reunification. And in many ways, this is also about the separation that incarceration causes. Stepping aside from really how these women responded, what is the ripple effect of incarceration, specifically on families?
That's kind of the whole focus of this camp, is working to support kids who have this experience, because it's an experience that more than 5.1 million kids in the country have a parent in either jail or prison in the United States. So 88,000 children in Wisconsin have this experience. So it's a widespread impact of mass incarceration that we don't always think about, that there are kids that are left behind. And I talked to an academic who has kind of studied the impact that that has on a child when their parent is incarcerated, and she described it as kind of a forced separation that can be a really traumatic experience for both the child and the parent, but especially for the child, that can have kind of short-term and long-term impacts on their mental health and well-being. And one of the most important things that she said to kind of help mitigate some of those negative impacts is to really maintain some kind of strong relationship with your parent who is incarcerated. So that's kind of what the point of this camp is to provide an opportunity to get to have that relationship, kind of keep that ongoing, keep that support intact, even when the parent is away from home.
Well, and it's really an opportunity to have private time with your child. You know, something that we talked about was this is, for many women, the first time since their incarceration that they're able to really just sit with their children without another adult, without a grandparent, without an aunt or uncle.
Yeah, so it's difficult for some of the children to get up to Tichita to see their mom. So a lot of them don't have the opportunity to do that very often. And even if they do, like you said, that someone has to bring them there. And so there's always going to be kind of a third party around. And this was really just an extended period of one-on-one time. It was a time for kids to kind of talk with their moms and get really honest and real about some of the feelings that come when the mom is away and when she is incarcerated. And I have talked to a lot of moms and kids, moms especially, who said that was really powerful to hear more about their kids' feelings and to kind of see the moments that they don't really see every day, to even see their kids get upset and cry about something or fight with their sibling, maybe the not-so-glamorous parts of parenthood, but to be together long enough to kind of experience that range of emotions. A lot of the women said that that was really powerful and beautiful for them to get to do that.
Well, and, you know, some of the kids you mentioned were angry. They're angry at their mothers, regardless of the circumstances that put their mothers in prison. They do feel this level of abandonment. And this kind of speaks to something that the warden spoke about with you, wanting to help women transition into what will be their normal lives after incarceration.
Yeah, a lot of the women talked about that this experience was so powerful for them that they got to spend that time with their kids and feel really excited about being able to go back to them and support them and wanting to be there for their kids. And they said as much as it was painful to be away, that being able to interact with them made them really excited. And so this opportunity was kind of a motivation to keep that up and to keep doing the hard work that they're doing to better themselves and get ready to be a supportive parent again. And so this is what the warden, Sarah Cooper, said that she heard from women about what this camp meant to them.
We have ladies who have said to us, you know, I found myself in this situation where I was really, really angry with another woman and I just wanted to, you know, revert back to my old ways of managing it, whether that's violence or whatever the case may be. And then she said, but I think about Camp Reunite coming up and I think about how much this means to my kids and I'm not gonna lose this opportunity. So I didn't engage. And they say, now, all the other stuff, it just doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is spending this time with my kids.
And I feel like this quote in particular is really key to this conversation, because I think people might be looking at this camp going, well, you know, that's great for these incarcerated mothers and great for their kids, I suppose. But what does the institution really get out of it? And, you know, I think the warden really explains that here.
I think it showed a lot that the institution cared enough to do this. The women did. They told me that they really appreciated that the institution made the effort to make this possible for them. And there were different prison staff that were volunteering and were part of the day and who were working the carnival games. And everyone kind of felt that benefit. I talked to a woman who was a recreational therapist at Tichita, and she was talking about just how powerful this is for the women to get to have this time and how special it is and how healing it is for a lot of them who don't get to see their families very often. So the prison staff was very supportive of this, and they saw it as beneficial because it was beneficial to the women and beneficial to their goals of helping the women prepare to re-enter society successfully and be contributing members of our communities.
Yeah. And for the kids, it seems like there's the obvious benefit of getting to spend time with their mothers. But, you know, something that we talked about a bit is, you know, the camp element of it, but also, you know, the fact that they're around a bunch of other kids who also have incarcerated mothers.
Yeah, that was kind of part of the intention behind the camp, to create this community of kids who have that shared experience, so hopefully that kids could find support among each other, and then that they could find support in their moms, but also in the camp staff. And so there were a whole wellness team of camp staff that worked on different activities and brought in music therapists and art therapists and kind of held discussions to help kids process their emotions. And then the, just camp counselors that are fun that the kids could lean on and talk to if they needed to work through maybe hard feelings, or just to have a fun time at summer camp and do archery and slide down the slide and whatever. But I think just having other kids who got what you're going through, like maybe they, some of the kids didn't have that at school, or maybe didn't talk about this experience that they had of having a parent incarcerated. So to have other kids around you that got that seemed really meaningful for a lot of the kids that I talked to. So Felicia was one of the women who I talked to, and her kids, Kayliana and Zacchaeus, talked to me about how that made them feel.
How does it make you feel being around other kids that have moms here? And how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel not lonely. I just feel normal.
You know, Kayliana, you have a video of her, but you might not be able to hear this from her voice. She's very young. She's a little girl.
She's young. She's 9 years old. Yeah, and there's a video, and there's a lot more information than I was able to talk about here today and the full story on MilwaukeeNNS.org, where there's a video where we hear more from Felicia and Kayliana and what this day was like for them, what this camp means for them.
And you can really see, you know, a number of the women who participated in the group and, you know, kind of their interactions during the day.
Yeah, it's really powerful. I mean, that's what one of the moms told me. They're like, this is the best versions of us. This is our mothering selves. And it was powerful for them to see each other like that. And I think, yeah, to see these other sides of themselves and to see that they are these caregivers, and it made people feel really purposeful and excited. And it's really special to see some of these moments. It's very tender moments.
Yeah, what was the experience like for you?
It was really beautiful, honestly. Even I knew it was going to be an emotional day, but when we were standing there at Tachita and the school bus pulled up in front, that the kids had arrived, and a lot of the women got up and went outside and were waiting in a row watching their kids get off the bus and watching their kids go through security and kind of picking their kids out from pretty far away and saying, like, oh, he looks so tall, or she got so big, or that one's mine in the back, I can tell he's nervous, and just kind of that anticipation. And it was just very tangible excitement and anticipation. You could tell it meant so much to everyone who got to participate in that day.
Well, Allison, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yeah, thanks so much, Joy.
Allison Dukanovich is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. She's a contributor to Lake Effect as well. She spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find her story at WUWM.com. And you can find more of Dukanovich's reporting on Wisconsin prisons by going to MilwaukeeNNS.org. We'll take a short break, and then writer Chuck Klosterman joins us to talk about his new short story collection, Raised in Captivity. Lake Effect continues with that conversation in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Chuck Klosterman's mind connects dots that most of us don't even see. It's sharp, inventive, funny, and a bit skewed, just like his writing. From articles in the New York Times, GQ, the AV Club, and The Guardian, to his own best-selling nonfiction and novels, Klosterman's voice is distinctive. His newest book is Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction, and he'll be in Milwaukee this Thursday evening at the Back Room at Collectivo to talk about it. The book is a first for Klosterman. It's a collection of short stories. Although when we chatted recently via Skype, he took pains to explain that he wasn't unfamiliar with the form.
I certainly wrote short stories when I was a high school student, but this is really the first time since then. I guess I've written 8 nonfiction books and 2 novels. I had wanted to write like a short story collection for a while. It's hard because within the book publishing industry, they view short story collections as kind of uncommercial. Like it's, they're very difficult to sell. And if you introduce the idea, they will almost try to convince you to do something else. This is particularly true with me because my nonfiction books sell so much better than my fiction. I'm not sure why that is, but it's just the reality. But, you know, I'm in a position now where I guess I have a little more leverage. And I said, I really want to do this. And I've had this idea probably for 5 years. I've been putting ideas together, you know, for this kind of collection. It was about 5 years worth of story. Like I was coming up with ideas. I hadn't started writing. And then I was in a position where I did it. And I must say, I mean, I'm always hesitant to say this because it seems like the fake thing people say when they're promoting books. But this was probably the most fun I had writing a book since the very first one. Like it was just a real enjoyable experience.
How long did it take to put it all together?
About a year.
Okay.
I had a very systematic approach to it. I would, for 5 years, anytime I had sort of an idea for a story or a weird piece of dialogue or maybe just like some kind of abstract concept, I'd type it into my phone, like in the notes app of my phone. And I ended up with hundreds of these. And at some point I decided, okay, so now I'm gonna do this book, right? And this seems crazy, but my initial idea was that I was going to write 100 stories that were all exactly 1,000 words long. I had this idea that this was going to be like this formalist obstruction I was going to pursue. So I start doing this. This is probably in, sometime in 2017. I had just moved to Portland, Oregon from Brooklyn. And then I start realizing that every story I'm working on, I'm either stretching up to make it 1,000 words, or I'm cutting it back down to fit it in this 1,000 word window. So every story is an unnatural length. And then I kind of concluded, well, of course, I'm also going to have this book edited, and copy editors and my editor and myself are going to make changes. And then I'm going to have to go back in and fix all these so it fits this magical number of 1,000. And then I guess I finally just kind of settled on the idea that this is stupid. Like, nobody cares about this. No one's going to read a book because the stories are all the exact same length. So then I said, I'm just going to write the stories the length they're supposed to be. And I ended up writing 50. I would usually do one story a week. I'd start the story Monday, finish it Tuesday. Wednesday, I would go back and edit last week's story. Thursday, I would go back to the work I did on Monday and Tuesday and see if it needed some sort of overhaul, and then finish up on Friday. Ended up with these 50 stories and then used the 34 best ones in the book.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say academics would love it if it was 1,000 because, you know, in the future you would be writing a story about how there was something magical about the fact that there were 100 stories of 1,000 words each.
Oh, yeah. It's like, it's almost like doing poetry. Like they always say this about poetry. Like if you really want to be, you know, famous and live forever, if you want to really have a legacy, go into poetry because 500 people will care now and 200 people will care in 100 years or whatever. I suppose if I had done this strangely shaped book that had this, you know, like this strict formalist rule, somebody, you know, it'd be like, right, you know, there was a guy a few years back, I can't remember the book, but like he wrote an entire book and he wouldn't use the letter E.
Yes.
That was sort of the thing. Like he wrote an entire, yeah.
Yes.
And I remember that someone did this. I do not remember the book or the guy, and I didn't read the book. So I guess that would have been the best case scenario, that in the future somebody said, oh, there was that maniac who wrote 100,000 word stories. I don't know who it was, and I didn't read it, but somebody did it.
But somebody did it. One of the great things about this is I'm a huge science fiction fan and was reading science fiction from when I was a little kid. I love the science fiction short story collections. I love Twilight Zone. And a lot of these feel like they could be Twilight Zone episodes now, current ones.
Well, you know, that if somebody were to ask me, like, what are these stories like, and please explain it in one sentence, I would say that they're kind of like literary Twilight Zone episodes because they're really compact. I mean, I think the longest story in here is like 2,200 words. There's not a lot of character development. There's not a lot of plot mechanics. The idea is the story, you know, and that's sort of how it was on like the Twilight Zone or like Black Mirror now, I guess is the modern Twilight Zone, where if you were to think about those episodes, you're not so much thinking about how they unspool. That's always part of it. But the main thing you're talking about is kind of the world that was created that it fits in. I mean, I was a big science fiction fan when I was a kid as well, and I still am. I've always liked terrestrial science fiction. Like, I was never interested in stuff out in outer space so much. I like things that happened on Earth or a skewed version of the reality of Earth. And I think a lot of these stories probably would fit into that sort of description.
Oh, absolutely. There's this, it's like we recognize this place, but there's a little bit of an angle, you know, or a little tweak to the left or the right, you know, that you kind of go, what, really? Oh, okay. And then you sit with it for a while as a reader and you go, well, yes, that actually somehow makes sense, even though it's not the reality I'm looking at necessarily every day.
Yeah, it's often a situation where it is all the aspects of our current reality with one significant thing shifted. And it's often the case with short stories. What a lot of the action is someone underreacting to an insane scenario or overreacting to kind of a basic, simplistic one. That's a big part of especially the way I write dialogue. I mean, very often I have characters in these scenarios where their response to things is not nearly as extreme as it should be, but that also normalizes it. It makes that reality seem more plausible because the person inside of it is behaving the same way we would behave if we got a parking ticket, even though what they're really responding to is, you know, the idea that probability no longer exists or whatever.
Right. Yeah, exactly. When you were working on the various stories, did you know what those moments were going to be, or did they surprise you as you were writing?
Well, it's a hard thing to answer because it's something that I should know because I'm talking about myself, but I almost feel like I don't. I mean, I sometimes use this. It's kind of a maybe tired metaphor, but like a lot of times I think this is like having a ball of yarn in your brain and all the information is there and you sort of know what the story is, but it would be difficult to sort of illustrate it until you start typing. And the process of typing is straightening out the yarn into string. And that's kind of how it is. I mean, if I started a story, in a way, I did know exactly what was going to happen before I even started, but I didn't know how it would be explained. And to me, that's kind of what almost one of the many things I like about writing is that, I mean, I'm just inherently kind of a confused person who feels like they have no control over how the world operates. But then when I'm writing something, I have this very, very insular experience where I'm just like a keyboard and the screen, and I can actually make sense of all these things that in truth I understand but can't control.
Yes. I was going to say, you have that momentary sense of controlling your environment, whatever that is. And, you know, most of us don't have any control over our environment. And so I imagine it's kind of seductive.
Well, yeah, seductive is I don't know if I would say it's seductive, but it is. There's a high level of freedom. I mean, say many people, you know, you want to be creative, you know, they want to have a creative life. And yet so many creative idioms don't really allow for individual agency. I mean, if you're a film director, you have to cast the movie and you have to get the script. And then there's all these technological elements and everything has to work together. If you're making a TV show and you're a TV writer, those are done in writing rooms with eight other people and it's all collaborative. If you're a musician, you know, you write the songs yourself, but then you have to go into the studio and the producer has input and there's all these other things, you know, about the live performance. Writing a book really is a singular thing. I mean, I live in Portland, and when I bought this house, there was this little log cabin in the backyard, kind of like a Ted Kaczynski cabin or whatever. So I put carpet in and I painted the walls, and now I have this great office, which is as close to my house as it can possibly be without being in my house. And I go in there after I take my kids to school, and I go in here at about 8:30 or 9 in the morning, and then I work from here until 5 when I got to get my kids. And it's just me, you know? And I think some people could hear that and they would be like, well, that's kind of, you know, depressing, but it feels the complete opposite to me. Like I guess I crave it almost, like, you know, so I am real lucky. I mean, I'll never forget how fortunate it is that my life worked out this way. I still kind of can't believe it, to be honest, but you know.
It almost, to me, as you're describing that, it sounds like you walk into that cabin and it's like your own TARDIS. It's much bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
Well, yeah, I guess that's one way of looking at it. I suppose, yeah, because if I wanted to travel through time, I could, in a way, I could write about, you know, the Bronze Age. And for a brief window of time, that's where I would be. It's just, you know, it's not like writing is easy. You don't want to come across and say, like, you know, oh, it's like it's nothing. Of course it's hard, but it's not hard the way I associated jobs growing up. Like, I came from a farm and I would kind of see how my dad and my brother would work. And I would, you know, nobody in my hometown seemed to like their job. Nobody. I mean, they probably did, but the idea of someone saying, like, I love what I do, I don't think I ever heard that one time growing up. So it does amaze me that the, you know, there's, you know, three parts of your life. You're asleep for 8 hours, you're working for 8 hours, and 8 hours are your own. I'm surprised that I have 16 hours that are kind of interchangeable. That seems like a real lucky break.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah, I think most people are going, yeah, can I have that, please? And again, it seems like that would be a story that would fit into this collection very nicely. I keep feeling like I wanted more stories, you know, that there were more things. And I know you said you had others that didn't make it into the book.
Yeah, like there's 34 in the book. And originally, I think there was 50. But some of them just weren't good enough. A few of them were too complicated to be the length of these stories. Like by the time I sort of described or like did that, I guess it's called world building. By the time I built the world, it was like, it's too long. There's no way I can have anything happen. A couple stories that got cut at the very end were because they seemed too closely tied to things that were going on in the world right now. And while I don't believe that this book is going to be read, you know, in 100 years, it could be read in 10 years. And I didn't want to have a situation where the value of the story was too, like, intertwined with people's knowledge of the popular culture in this specific moment. So those got moved out. And I just, you know, any story that to me seemed a little bit boring had to go. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the worst thing you can say about a nonfiction book is that this is untrue. These facts are wrong. The worst thing you can say about a fictional book is that this is dull. This is boring. And I just, you know, the goal, if I have one, is to have a short story collection that's interesting and entertaining.
When you come here to Milwaukee to do your onstage portion of this, what is that going to involve? Are you going to read? How are you going to bring the stories to life for an audience?
Well, now, I think, I'm not 100% sure, but I think someone is interviewing me on stage, in which case that will probably be the main thing I will do. If that isn't the case, if I'm wrong about this, I probably will read one story because they are pretty compact. Like, I can read a story in 10 or 12 minutes, you know, if people want me to read, I will. I have to say, at book readings, I typically find the reading portion by far the worst part. And I often feel like the audience is waiting for the bozo to quit reading so they can ask questions, because the reading is the one thing they can definitely do on their own. I mean, reading is an, you know, interior process or whatever. I think a lot of times people come to a book event because they want to sort of understand the person who wrote it and sort of have a kind of a glimpse at the source of the material, and that recontextualizes the material. So the main thing I do is I just take questions from the audience. And the thing I always say is that you do not have to ask me questions about this book. You can ask me questions about anything, because since I've done so much nonfiction, a lot, you know, mostly about music, sports, film, and television, I think a lot of times people just want to ask me about that stuff, or you know, the early part of my career, there was a lot of memoir kind of material, and people sometimes are curious about, you know, those things. And sometimes people just want to ask me about politics and current events. And the thing is, I'm kind of open to all of it. I think some people go to a book reading and they feel this obligation, like, well, I should ask this guy about the craft of writing or whatever. It's like, you don't got to do that with me. Anything is fine.
And you talked about, you know, having audience members wanting to know more about the person who created the worlds in the book or whatever, all the books. And, you know, the subtitle of this is Fictional Nonfiction. So there is a lot of you in there, including that little log cabin.
Well, you know, I said, like, how some in the early part of my career as an author, like, you know, the first three books particularly are sometimes directly labeled as memoir. They're seen as memoirs. You know, they didn't seem that way to me when I wrote them, but that's how they were, you know, kind of interpreted. And yet I would say that this is probably the most personal book I've ever written. And that seems really odd considering what the content of those early ones, but those books were really about my external life. What I was doing, the people in my life, the activities I was pursuing, sort of the way I was interacting with the world. This book is about my interior life. Like, this is what I daydream about when I'm by myself. This is sort of what I think when I'm driving, and a lot of things that I don't talk about, even like with my wife or whatever. They're just things that I think about. And I don't know if anyone reading this book will feel that. Like, I think that a lot of people will read this book and they'll be like, well, this is almost like absurdism or like, you know, it's like, this is kind of absurdist humor, and it is, but I guess to me, it feels like a real close projection of my mind. But, you know, I guess I don't want people to realize that, although I just told them on the radio. So who knows? What am I doing?
I think the secret's out. And, you know, I think a lot of us think about these things in these odd, absurd, you know, taking things down, you know, down a particular path and seeing where it goes. But most of us don't have the skill to write it down.
Yeah, well, the question is, do I? That's the thing, because sometimes, like, I do think the ideas in this story are good. The execution, that's subjective. I worry sometimes that maybe my ambition is greater than my actual ability, that maybe what I want to do or what I envision myself doing is one thing, and then my actual skill at executing that is another. But you got to try. You know, it's like you get one chance in life to do these things, and you just got to do them.
Well, I have to say, I'm really glad you did this one. Chuck Klosterman, it has been such an honor to have you back on Lake Effect, and we're so looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'm looking forward to everyone or anyone who comes out.
Chuck Klosterman's newest book is a short story collection called Raised in Captivity, Fictional Nonfiction. He'll be in Milwaukee at the Back Room at Collectivo on Thursday evening. You can find the details at WUWM.com. We will take one last break, and then Milwaukee writer Christina Ward gives us a history of 20th century America through our food. We learn more about the influence of American advertising cookbooks when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Have you ever wondered why such a thing as a gingered pear and chicken salad served in lime jello exists? What about baked bananas rolled in ham served with a cheese sauce? Or anything at all made with Spam or even just Spam itself? The foods and recipes that many of us grew up with were thanks to American corporations and their advertising departments. Not only were the corporations promoting the products they were selling, they were also promoting what it meant to be an American. Christina Ward's latest book, American Advertising Cookbooks, looks at how things like Jell-O, bananas, and Spam became household staples, and it's a fascinating story. She first joined me in the studio back in February to explain that this book came out of her first one, Preservation, The Art and Science of Canning, Fermentation, and Dehydration.
In doing all my research about the history of food preservation, it became really, really clear that food preservation in and of itself was such a cataclysmic event in culinary history. And then when you look, start peeling that back and looking closer, the ability to keep food longer than a few days changed how we're going to eat, because then it enabled just your small farmer to have a few more days, and then he could take it to market. And then those market folks then became processors, as they would make things out of it. And then it just, the business expanded. I mean, if you think about Hellman's mayonnaise was started by Richard Hellman in, I think, 1910. And he owned a small deli in New York City. And he and his wife made their recipe mayonnaise in the back of the shop and sold it out of the shop. And because of the technology of being able to preserve things and then start marketing and the distribution, within 3-4 years, he was nationwide.
And you think, yes, we are a business-oriented culture. You know, Americans are very good about the bootstrap thing and the entrepreneur thing and making stuff to sell. Corporations somehow took over.
They did. And it, I think that there's a myth that this rise of corporations is, you know, something of a recent of memory. It's not. So even with the example of Hellman's, they started, and by the 1920s, in the span of 10 years, they were bought out by another company that eventually became General Foods. So,
although they kept the name Hellman's.
They did keep the Hellman's as a brand, and that's one of the, I think, the things that's really interesting, is that a lot of the foods that we're familiar with today that we think are just freestanding things are just brand names, and they're owned by a larger corporate entity. And that's started right in the 1910s. This is coming out of the kind of that gilded age of the corporate robber barons. And so there was almost like an American mania for building the biggest company you possibly could. And the laws at the time kind of helped that along. What we think of as like some of the anti-monopoly laws didn't really come in till after the 1920s. And since they were enacted in the 20s, they've been kind of peeled back, you know, a little bit at a time until now, where, again, we're in a position where a lot of what they call holding companies are owning a diversified portfolio of actual companies. So you've got food manufacturers that are also cigarette manufacturers and sellers. And so it's a interesting food landscape.
Well, and as you say, it started 100 years ago, really,
it
in
did,
this country.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that we have somehow maybe tried to reverse that a little bit in the last decade or so, where, you know, we're interested in going to farmers markets and buying somebody's local preserves, or we're interested in finding out who actually owns the companies that produce the food that we eat.
And I think it's the arc. I'm a fan of pure science, but I'm also cautious about applied science, because sometimes the applied sciences are applied by corporations, and that's the unintended consequences. And I think we have to remember culturally, we're not too far away from actual starvation, where people did starve, where, you know, if you didn't know where your next meal was coming from for the next few days, you were really in trouble. And so that ability to preserve food and then fortify it and inoculate it with antibacterials and vitamins and, you know, make it more than what it actually is, when it first started in the 20s and 30s and 40s, it really served a great purpose and helped people. But the unintended consequences, of course, are the increased amounts of salts and sugars that have added to the obesity crisis in the United States. So that helped trigger that kind of the consciousness about, like, what are we really eating here? And do we really want to eat this?
Did it also affect the idea of sort of corporate agriculture, where we have monocrops because we have to support the kind of processing that you're describing here?
Absolutely. That's the story of bananas. Bananas are a monocrop. They are asexual reproducers, which means, like a tuber, like when you're planting tulips, you have to put the thing in the ground to get the thing to a fruit. And by doing that, with one variety over time through Central America that decimated the local kind of flora and agriculture systems, not to mention because something like a banana, which has really only a few natural predators and doesn't really evolve in its DNA, is very susceptible to things like a root rot or a leaf rot. And so Central America itself has been poisoned over the past 70 years by pesticides. And so, again, it's unintended consequences. We want bananas. We like bananas. But now bananas are actually on the verge of extinction because the predatory viruses and blights that have been evolving to eat those bananas are winning. So right now, and again, this is kind of the interesting thing with the science of bananas, and it's happening, as you said, with a lot of other crops too, is how do we protect from vermin and with pesticides? And so that next phase is now you're seeing a lot of what they call genetically modified, where much of the wheat crop and corn crops and soy crops in the United States are actually modified that have the pesticide adjusted in the actual seed. And so the plant itself is resistant to any type of blight.
So how did we learn to love Spam, which is one of the things you mentioned?
The story of Spam is so interesting. Again, it comes out of food preservation. In 1906, there was a law finally passed called the Food and Drug Act. And it was the first time in the United States that we had any kind of national rules about what actually was food. And it actually published a book called The Formulary, and it defined every kind of food and what was in it, what it could contain. And before that, there were a lot of food scares, contaminated foods and things passed off as food that wasn't. And so the idea of a Spam, which is a pork byproduct, mostly fat with a lot of salt, prior to the development in World War I, would have never passed muster with the United States because the consumer was afraid of any kind of adulterated foods. But through really good marketing, which was the idea of saying, this is for the country, this is healthy, it's fortified, it's got vitamins, it's inexpensive, and so you should eat it. You know, you're doing your part for the war efforts by giving it to your friends and family. And so it was also served as a military ration. And so post-World War II then, as many soldiers came home, they developed a taste for that salty, porky fat, which, you know, fry it up. It's kind of delicious in a terrible way. And so the marketing then changed to say, you know, reward your hardworking men with, you know, Spam. And that's really how they taught us to love that taste.
Well, and it sounds like it's both, and I hesitate to use the word collusion because maybe that's too strong a word for it, but between corporations and the government, if it's like for the war effort.
Oh, there's collusion.
Okay, so it's not too strong a word.
Oh, it is not too strong a word at all, because one of the pioneers of food advertising was Edward Bernays. Edward Bernays, who's the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who was trained in the early psychoanalytic techniques and understanding of human psychology. His first job before he went into advertising was working for the Committee for the Public Interest, which was a precursor to the CIA and was in charge of propaganda during World War I and up until the early 1930s. So there's a definite relationship between governments and advertising and corporations. Funnily enough, I mean, it comes to his partners he was working with at the CPI were the Dulles brothers, the infamous Dulles brothers, who one headed up the CIA and then one worked for John Kennedy.
And had an airport named after him.
And has an airport named after him. So again, and this also, I think, tells the story. It's a smallness. And I think, you know, part of that, we forget. We think we're a big country, but we find it here in Milwaukee, kind of that joke of small walkie. When you're working in the elite, the corporations, we're looking at some of the early founding families, everybody knew everybody. So it wasn't necessarily a malicious collusion, but it was a friendly collusion of like, this is the guy you went to Harvard with. This is the guy you served in the early propaganda outfit with. And they all helped each other.
Before we turned on the microphones, we were talking about how this is about way more than food. It's about culture and defining culture and what is acceptable and what isn't through the advertising, through the kind of foods that you were told to eat or encouraged to eat. And, you know, it even involved gender norms.
Absolutely. And this is where I think that I wanted to tell this story, because it was that one time that I could pinpoint in the kind of American history of when we really became Americans. And it was that idea of the communications, printing presses became cheap. The food became cheaper. Travel, railroads opened up the country to the expansion, immigrants coming in. So we had all these different influences, and then people trying to control those outcomes and then having the tools to do it. So when you talk about like the idea of food from our early Puritan founders, they had very distinct ideas about what food was proper. I mean, if you're looking at early Protestant food cookbooks, there's no spices for a number of reasons. And that through line, through again, through those families and through those generations, the traditions held true. So, you know, we're still in the 1930s and 40s and covering everything in white sauce, which is, you know, not a bechamel. It's just flour and a little milk. It's not really, it's more like paste. But the idea was, is to keep everything packed full of calories, because you needed it if you're going to work in a factory or a farm, and keep everybody eating in a very similar way, because you didn't want things that would be too exciting or too outside what the norm was. And so that's where you get like the great Born in Milwaukee, the Settlement Cookbook, which was founded by earlier settler German Jews. And as that second wave of Jewish immigration came to Milwaukee, which were mostly Eastern European and Ashkenazi Jews, who had a totally different type of outlook on food and cooking. And, you know, the highborn, very elite German Jews wanted to teach the newcomers, this is how you're American. You cook like us. And that became like a real through line through a lot of the immigrant groups had different settlement houses that were usually funded by the wives of the manufacturer factory owners here in Milwaukee. And they each had a way to help teach the kids, teach everybody, again, how to be American. And being American meant being more Protestant, more conservative, and, you know, less fun, really.
No spices.
No spices. Yeah.
Where do you see this kind of influence happening now? Do we have the same sort of need to look to corporations to tell us how to eat like an American?
I think we're more savvy to advertisers, but we're not immune. I think where you see a lot of it more is with cooking shows and, you know, this is just a theory because of how we, you know, ate a lot of boxed canned foods growing up for a certain period of time, is that a lot of our food marketing is aspirational. And so what you'll see a lot of is the food, the kits, I think, are really an interesting phenomenon. So when you see those pre-made food kits, or you can order online, or they have delivered, it's essentially buying food in a box, the same thing it was, you know, 50 years ago. But they've kind of zhuzhed up the marketing, and you see happy people with their families and the time. And it has this really wonderful aspirational aspect to it. And I think that's where the marketing is going right now. And I think we should also be cautious of it, because the negative connotations, again, are describing who gets to be an American. So you see these like beautiful, thin people making their dinners, and they're all in these very upper middle class houses. And so we have to be really careful, again, about the messages of class and gender, and, you know, how we judge people who are eating what kind of food.
Well, and those meal kits that you're talking about, the food may come in a box, but it aspires to be fresh.
Exactly. There's still some level of preservation and artificiality going on with those.
Has to be.
It has to be.
Yeah. How is it going to come to your house in a box and not be rotten?
Right. And fundamentally, it's still, you know, I find it really interesting because just like the reading the box of macaroni and cheese where it's like, you know, boil noodles, add the things, those meal kits with that idea of aspirational freshness are still like you follow just the instructions. Don't you're not actually cooking. You're just following instructions. And that is, I think, one of the consequences of this time period in advertising cooking. It kind of took away the ability to cook. There's a whole multiple generations of folks who don't really know how to cook things anymore. I'm pro bringing back some home economics education for kids.
I completely agree. And in Europe, they still do. And it's both genders. It's not assumed that it's just girls.
What's interesting when you say Europe, too, is the Europeans, of course, there's processed food in Europe, but there's less effect, overall effect, than here in the United States. The corporate hold on the American food systems was so pervasive throughout the entire food system, say from like the 20s through the 70s, even now, that it was able to really shape, how we eat overall, and less so in Europe. So again, they're still fighting some of the obesity crisis that come from processed foods, but not to the extent that we are here in the United States.
It's true. I mean, for example, when I was in Germany, I heard a lot from my German colleagues about how Americans have ammonia chicken and they don't want it. They won't eat it. Because it's processed with ammonia to probably kill whatever it's going to, you know.
Extends the life.
Yeah. And they just will not have it.
And I think that's where more Americans need to. And again, there's so many different influences to find that balance. If you're going to Outpost to buy pure natural chicken or to Whole Foods, you're charged a premium for that. And so in the United States, freshness is at an expense. So if you're not in a financial position to spend, you know, X amount per week on your food budgets, your choices are quite limited. And again, that's a product of the American corporations, that they can pull the nutrient levels down, they can mass package things, and you can get the caloric intake up and the nutrient levels just about barely acceptable and make it cheap enough that poor people can eat it.
Right. That's, and I was going to say, there's the word cheap enough.
Right.
Because if nothing, you know, we look for bargains in this country. That's a cultural thing, is that we all want a bargain.
We do want a bargain. And I think, and that's a great disconnect. You and I were talking earlier. I think the difference, and that's, you know, part of what an American is seeing the cost without seeing the value. And so I think we need to find more value and worry about cost a little differently.
Well, Christina Ward, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Milwaukee author Christina Ward's newest book is American Advertising Cookbooks, How Corporations Taught Us to Love Spam, Bananas, and Jell-O. We first spoke with her in February. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.